Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man of truly uncommon intelligence is going to grace us for this full hour to brief us, well, both on the war for the free world, if you will, as it has been struggled over for centuries now, one might argue, mostly, but not exclusively, but importantly, shaped by actual battles, actual campaigns, actual conflicts. He is a deeply thoughtful student of these subjects, as well as really an extraordinarily accomplished Renaissance man in a whole host of fields. He is the author of 6 critically acclaimed and best-selling novels, multiple works of nonfiction, including the one we'll be speaking about today, a record-setting television movie, and several motion picture scripts. He has been highly successful in every field, I think, to which he's turned his hand. His name is Michael Walsh. I'm proud to call him a friend as well as a most admired inspiration, and we're bringing him to you in part to talk about his newest and extraordinary work entitled Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. Michael Walsh, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us. And congratulations on this new book. And I'm anxious to talk with you about a number of the insights that you draw from Why Men Fight When All Is Lost, in specific pitched battles in which their mettle was sorely tested and inevitably there was tremendous sacrifice. But before we do, I'd like to just sort of set the stage for all of that by teasing out with you kind of the central thesis of the piece. Some have, I think, described this as an ode to masculinity and something of a assault on some of the current nostrums about, you know, female power and toxic masculinity and the like. Tell us a little bit about your thinking on sort of the historical context in which we're living through such interesting and peculiar times.
Well, I start from this proposition, Frank, as a cultural historian. People don't change, human nature doesn't change, and the course of human activity doesn't change. What does change is, of course, things like the technological trappings of the era, certain social issues that come and go, get resolved, come back again. I must say my thinking for many years has been influenced by the great Camille Paglia, and in particularly Sexual Personae, which I first read back in the 1980s when it was recommended to me by my editor at Time Magazine, then when I was serving as that magazine's music critic. What she did, starting with the ancient Egyptians and going forward, examining notions of sexuality throughout cultural history, has been an inspiration to me in terms of my own work. So, as you know, as we've discussed, I did 2 books previously called The Devil's Pleasure Palace and The Fiery Angel, which is about Western culture and the assault on Western culture. Apparently, I didn't know it at the time I wrote the first of those 2 books, but Western culture is racist, sexist, classist, and homophobic and xenophobic and all the usual Marxist nostrums and criticism. So I pointed that out, that this is effectively Marxism, which is a cultural theory that actually antedates Marx and will never die. I characterize it as satanic in my first big book, The Devil's Pleasure Palace. And I think Last Dance, the book, is an outgrowth of that thinking. So again, I had started with the Greeks at Thermopylae and worked my way through idiosyncratic selection of battles right up to the Marine Corps at the Chosin Reservoir. And that battle has a special resonance for me because my father fought in that battle with the 2-5 in Korea and survived it. So I realized I had a survivor of The Last Stand in my own family, and that really gave me the impetus, and in addition to all the cultural elements of it, to write this book with the dedication and passion that it needed on such a big subject.
Just a further word on masculinity. You really define it, Michael Walsh, as, you know, fundamentally a sort of genetic predisposition to fight, often heroically, usually for the protection of women and children. But describe this in, again, the context of this sort of modern attitude that all of this is so passé, that if ever it were true, it is no longer true, and that diplomacy is now the norm, and peace is sort of the default setting for the human condition. It's not so, according to your book, but, you know, just give us that setting for the conversation we'll shortly have about just how badly off that is.
Yeah, well, anyone who thinks that should read Immanuel Kant, I know that's something you can't ask anybody to read today, since they have the reading comprehension of what were very stupid third graders in my days in grade school. But Kant says the natural state of man is war. Look, nothing ever changes with human beings. Nothing, nothing, nothing. The essential nature remains inviolate. And while we may think we are more sophisticated than, say, the Greeks, the Romans, the men of Charlemagne, the Renaissance, well, we're certainly not smarter than the Renaissance, but no, more sophisticated in our social attitudes, we have to realize that our current social attitudes are luxuries that we cannot afford as a civilization. Societies periodically indulge in magical and wishful thinking, which is something we're going through right now on a very large cultural scale, something that's it's starting to look very much like the great cultural revolution in China back in the 1960s. It seems to make us feel better to be iconoclastic, which literally means the smashing of icons. But when we're done, what have you got? You have an unused church full of rubble, and the barbarians are at your gate. So what I'm arguing is that the so-called toxic masculinity is a necessary element of civilization. And what third-wave feminism has identified as poisonous is actually the thing that's going to save them when the chips are down. In the end, Colonel Nicholson is right. You want us on that wall. You need us on that wall.
We're going to pick up on the men who made the wall at Thermopylae with Michael Walsh on the other side of a very short break. Thank you for taking the time to really drill down on these incredibly important themes and insights, Michael, and we'll look forward to visiting with you about them in some detail momentarily. I'll be right back.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom. With Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back in this hour-long conversation with an incredibly creative and accomplished intellect by the name of Michael Walsh. In virtually every field of creative endeavor, he has excelled, and that is the case, to be sure, with his newest book. It is entitled Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All is Lost. And Michael, you've nicely set the predicate for a drill down on specific instances in which men have fought when all is lost. And you start with the Greeks at Thermopylae, and I'd like you to take a few minutes to sort of explore that with us, why that matters, why it's a fitting place to begin this Odyssey, no pun intended.
No pun intended, right, or this Ulyssiad, perhaps. Look, everything starts with the Greeks, Frank, because, in fact, we start with the Greeks. Without the Greeks holding that pass for 3 days at Thermopylae, according to the ancient historians and the legends that have grown up around it, Europe would have been invaded and conquered by the Persian Empire, which was the greatest political entity at that time. And the difference between the philosophy of the Persians and the philosophy of the nascent West at that point was absolutely antithetical. When antitheses meet, collision happens, and it happened at this narrow little pass caught between the hills and the ocean in Greece as Xerxes invaded the Attic states way back in 480 BC. The Greeks are curious people. They're hard for us to relate to in a way. They seem quite alien to us until, and I think this is crucial to understanding the military history, is their cultural history. For this book, for the last two, and for my next one, which I can mention at the end of our conversation today, I've spent a great deal of time with Greek drama. And if there's anyone who doubts that the Greeks are us, you need only to read the great plays of Sophocles and Aristophanes and Aeschylus. It's amazing how the situations of the time, albeit that they're set among gods who don't exist and people who have been dead for two millennium, are exactly us. Medea's rage over the loss of her lover leads her to kill her children. The way that the gods and man intertwine, and the gods are so very human in all of their faults, makes us reassess our own relationship with the religions that have come after that, especially in the West, Christianity. They're riveting, the language is stunning, the insights into human character are amazing. And so when I see the Greeks in battle, and who invented this notion of the phalanx in order to be able to use it both defensively and offensively, you knew that they were standing for something. And what they were standing for in a literal sense is each other. Those formations, which the Romans later turned into the maniples of the legions, were about one man standing cheek to jowl with his comrades in arms, armed similarly, drilled in the same tactics. And the man's duty was not only to kill the enemy, but as important was to protect the man to his right. So that the Greek phalanx, for example, with these long, long, big spears and pikes, looks like a giant hedgehog or an armadillo, and it would come at these more fleet, horseback-oriented armies and just chew them up. They would crash on the rocks of the phalanx, and then the Greeks would slaughter them. That was eventually improved on as we go forward. But that concept of the Western way of war, as my friend and colleague Victor Davis Hanson calls it, has remained the formations that have won every major struggle for the West for the last 2,000 years of history. So we owe the Greeks our culture, and we also owe the Greeks our fighting ethos. And from that seed grows Western civilization.
And it's so interesting that you point to this defense of the man to your right. I mean, that relationship of the warrior to his comrade that at some point, I think it's clear, you know, is the defining sentiment of men in combat, is it not?
Yes, it is. And that's one of the theses that runs through the entire book. I got this from a long, to jump to the end quickly, I got this from a very long series of interviews I did with my own father a couple of years ago, talking about the attack that the Chinese launched against a very small force of Marines in November of 1950. in the end, what these guys fight for, they may go to war for one thing. We've all seen the pictures of the World War I doughboys and the European soldiers marching off and home by Christmas, blah, blah, blah. They think they're fighting for king and country and Kaiser and everybody. But in the end, when the chips are down, and in these battles, which I must warn or perhaps recommend to the reader, are very bloody and gory, they fight for each other. They don't even fight for their own survival. They fight for the survival of their comrades. And that is such an elemental masculine thing that it's very hard to see women appreciating that. The female nature, I do believe, and I think history bears us out on this, is quite different from the male nature. That doesn't mean it's inferior. It means it's complementary. And women tend not to act instinctively in what are effectively platoons. Any boy that's ever played sandlot sports knows that the males organize themselves almost spontaneously into units. You're the pitcher. You're the kid. You're the right. You're the poor kid that gets to play right field because we hope nobody ever hits the ball to you. There's a natural hierarchy among men that is not true among women. Women are much more individually competitive with each other than men are, who tend to work in concert and in harmony. Now, yes, there's obviously a million exceptions to this, and we're speaking very broadly and generally, but women wouldn't have invented the Greek phalanx or the Roman legions. They wouldn't have fought well in them. They wouldn't have enjoyed the experience. It would not have worked, and they would have been defeated by a force that's even more masculine than the one they're trying to fight for. The Arabs, in their own way, understand this, and the Arab-Muslim view of women is quite striking and quite different from the Western view, which is always amuses me that women would be attracted to that sort of life. But perhaps it makes sense in another context. But we've decided for reasons that have evolved over the last 60, 70 years, that women and men are exactly the same. And history, to paraphrase Henry Ford, tells us that that is bunk. It just is bunk.
You've jumped from Thermopylae to Chosin, and there's a lot of country that you cover, or world, I should say, that you cover in between. You have talked about the Romans. You have talked about the Jews at Masada. What else should we take away from the ancients before we hit the Middle Ages and some of the great battles of that period?
Now, I think the thing about the Greeks and the Romans, I'm very much involved with Roman history right now for another project, is they are, in a way, the thing that the feminists despise the most. Their men fought for avarice reasons. They fought for glory. Caesar fought for money. In those days, the generals raised their own armies, their own legions, and paid them out of their own pocket. And the way you paid them was to conquer the guy you were after and take all of his stuff and then parcel it out. They had this ruthless determination, and talk about toxic masculinity. To read any accounts of early Roman history, such as by Tom Holland, who is a great British writer on this subject, the whole notion of the male organ was all over Rome. It was painted on walls. It was used as a decorative element. It was designed to keep away evil spirits. I mean, if you want to see a toxically male environment, just check out the wonderful series HBO did on Rome, and you will see it. And yet the Roman women were honored, admired, were extremely well known. There were prominent female personages in Rome. They just didn't fight with the legions. And what brought down Antony in the end was Cleopatra's wish to be present at the Battle of Actium. And when she panicked and fled, Antony abandoned the field. And that's fled back to Alexandria with his lover, and that's how Augustus became Augustus. Octavian beat him at Actium, and that was the end of Mark Antony. There's a whole lot of cautionary tales here. The Jews at Masada interested me because they were so determined not to fall into the Roman hands, because nothing good was going to happen to you if you did. And the Romans were furiously trying to finish what the Romano-Jewish historian Josephus calls the Jewish War. It's a riveting account. However trustworthy or untrustworthy, it's hard to tell. But it's from Josephus that we get the story that the Jews up at the top of this fortress, which had been built by Herod, staved off the Romans until the last possible moment and then essentially killed themselves. But because of the Jewish prescription against suicide, they drew lots and each one killed 10, and then they lowered it. And finally, only one had to kill himself, and that's how they defeated the Romans.
Michael Walsh, we will come back with more of these last stands and insights into what they not only did to define the time, but also the future, including ours. We'll be right back with more with the author of Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are talking about what makes men men and what men do instinctively, which, according to our guest and author Michael Walsh, is fight. And he describes how they do so even when all is lost in his marvelous new book, Last Stands. We're discussing this epic treatment of a highly topical, I guess it's fair to say, but also controversial subject with him for this full hour, for which I'm very grateful. Michael Walsh, take us to Sigathar, a battle that I suspect most in our audience have never heard of. What was it? Where was it? And why was it so important?
Yeah, Sigathar is called sometimes the battle that saved Western civilization. I don't think very many Americans have ever heard of it. It's obviously an important battle in Hungary. Where it took place. I went to Sigetvar during the research for this book and spent a week there walking among the restored elements of that particular castle, walled, crenellated place, and to soak up the spirit and to listen to the ghosts of the men who fought there. Basically, this was the invasion of the Turks in 1566 on their way to Vienna and to Rome. Remember, the goal of Islamic conquest has always been three places. The first one was Constantinople, which was the new Rome. And the second one was Vienna, which was the thing that impeded them on their way to the third, which is Rome itself. So Suleiman the Magnificent pulled together a giant army, and he fought the West both at sea and at land. And the battle for the land battle took place in Sigetvar, which is a small town in what's now southwestern Hungary. And it was defended by Count Jurini and his mixed group of Croatian and Hungarian fighters. Very small band there that was suddenly surrounded by Suleiman the Magnificent. The Turks in those days had one advantage over the West, which was their cannons were the best in the world. The Turks were not very good shots. The West has been lucky to run up against enemies who are really pretty terrible at shooting muskets and rifles. The Indians against Custer were not good shots at all, and the Turks were not famous for their marksmanship. In fact, they were derided for it, but they were like a wave. And their cannons would pound your walls to pieces. And what happened was the men at Sigetvar eventually got down to their very last stronghold. Most of them had been killed. And Zirini looked at his surviving men and he said, what are we going to do? So what they did is they had all the gunpowder. They had plenty of armaments. And they lit a very long fuse on this gunpowder. And then they opened the last gate and they charged out at the Turks. Almost sort of like Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid at the end of that, where they don't realize how many Bolivian troops are there to start shooting at them. They all crashed out and they were killed to the last man. And the Turks rushed into the castle keep, and then the gunpowder blew up and killed another 2,000 or 3,000 Turks, according to the legend. It's the subject of a famous Hungarian epic poem, which is absolutely riveting, called The Siege of Sigetvar. And it stopped Suleiman, who died the night before the final battle. We don't know why, but that was the end of that Muslim invasion of the frontiers of Europe. And it wasn't for another 100 years that they were able to finally assault Vienna. And as you know, they lost there as well.
One of the most fabled, I think it might be called, of last stands was that of George Custer at Little Bighorn. You devote the largest single chapter of this masterwork, Michael Walsh, to this battle. To talk about why and what's the principal takeaway?
Well, when we think of last stands, we think, especially as Americans, we think of two in particular, the Alamo and Custer at the Little Bighorn. I've always been fascinated by the figure of Custer, and I think he's been maligned, especially in modern scholarship and certainly in modern entertainment, historical-based entertainment. This was a man who, in his early 20s, was the youngest breveted general in the American army. He was a cavalry officer. He was absolutely the bravest person who ever walked the planet. He had what he called Custer luck and what his men called Custer luck in the Civil War, and that bullets would practically literally bounce off him. There's an account at one point where a Confederate, he comes across him suddenly on his horse. The guy starts to shoot, and I think the bullet bounces off Custer's sword or something. Custer takes his sword out and cuts the man's head off and keeps going. I mentioned earlier that the bloodiness of these battles is something that I think is shocking to modern sensibilities and certainly to female sensibilities. Throughout, from the Greeks up through the Sigetvar, which we just talked about, to Custer, you read heads are getting lopped off. The Crusaders, for example, when they first encountered the Islamic armies, were so big and strong compared to the Muslims that they were able to literally chop a man in half and take his horse's head off, too, with the kinds of weapons that they were carrying. These accounts of these battles are bathed in gore. So Custer was this startlingly successful but arrogant and confident guy who ran afoul of Ulysses S. Grant, the greatest American who ever lived, but was beloved by Grant's adjutant, Little Phil Sheridan, who was the head of the Union cavalry. And Sheridan protected him from Grant's wrath from time to time. Eventually, Custer went out to fight the Indians, and as we all know, that he was killed at the Battle of the Little Bighorn, along with a couple hundred of his men in 1876. People sometimes think of Custer as a foolhardy guy. He split his forces, which he shouldn't have done. There's a lot of armchair generaling here. But what was fascinating to me about Custer is that he did it for political purposes. I think almost nobody knows this, but his idea in 1876, when there was a three-pronged pincer movement against Sitting Bull and the off-the-reservation Indians, literally had left the reservation and were at quartering at the Little Bighorn. Custer's idea was to get there ahead of everybody else, which he always wanted to do, and then win this battle easily, and then go back to New York City and run for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States. So, in a way, Little Bighorn is the world's worst campaign event, since Custer did not walk away from that battle. He didn't have the intelligence, and obviously the chapter is called Big Village, which is literally Custer's last words. As he wrote an order, he said, "Big Village, come quick, bring packs." And packs were ammunition. Then, for emphasis, bring packs. So he ran out of ammo, he ran out of men, he ran out of time. And that battle was over very, very quickly because he was on an indefensible hillock, which is now known as Last Stand Hill. But what a magnificent American he was. He actually liked the Indians. People think he did this because he was a genocidal, bloodthirsty maniac. But if you read his writings, which he published in a book called My Life on the Plains, his attitude was, don't try to westernize the Indians, because if you do, you will ruin them. And I speak as someone who's part Native American. My own father's, one of his grandmothers was a full-blooded Mi'kmaq Indian from Nova Scotia. The Indians, Custer felt, would be better off separate. and not forced into religious schools and not forced to wear shoes. He was actually kind of a cultural radical on this point, although at the end it didn't do him any good, of course.
Which brings us to a more modern time, the Battle of Stalingrad, an epic struggle. You talk about the scene at Pavlov's house. Give us a sense of why you focused on that and, again, its bearing on the course of history.
Stalingrad's such an enormous battle, 2 million man armies colliding over the course of a brutal winter house-to-house fight. It had to be personalized. And what interested me about this battle, and it relates somewhat to the Alamo, is that it became a propaganda rallying cry. You know, remember the Alamo obviously did. And as I point out in the Alamo chapter, is it possible for a last stand to be politically incorrect, which is a conversation perhaps for another time. But the Soviets needed a hero, and this young Pavlov, his name was, managed to grab an apartment building that was crucially located on the German-held side of the river, the Volga River. And he and a handful of men, according to the Soviet propagandists of the time, held out against the Germans for a goodly long time, fought back, killed a lot of them, and became epic heroes. This story is partly true. We're not sure exactly how much of it is true. But I thought by personalizing the privations these guys underwent and the desperate odds they had, there was no choice in Stalin's army. You went forward, or the man behind you shot you dead and walked over your body. The Chinese communists at the Chosen Reservoir had the same philosophy. And when you fell because of the weapons shortage, the guy behind you picked up your rifle and he kept going until he was killed. The Soviets, talk about Grant the Butcher, the Soviets under Zhukov were willing to throw as many men into this fight as they had to. And they brought them in from all over the Soviet Union, including a great number of fighters from the East. And many of these guys took part in that Pavlov's battle. And what's interesting is that after the war, when Pavlov was this, during the war and after the war, when Pavlov was this national hero, they wrote the other ethnicities out of it. So Pavlov became the perfect Slavic warrior against the Germans. It was a stunning propaganda victory for the Soviets.
Even though he lost his life.
Well, he survived this battle. Yeah, and he became an elected official of various Soviet bodies. And he dined out on this for a long time. The question is how much of it is true and how much it actually matters whether it's true. There's a movie called Enemy at the Gates, which depicts the fight for Stalingrad very, very effectively. And you can see in that how the Soviet propaganda machine milked it for all it was worth.
To try to prevail in this terrible war effort. We'll come right back with more with Michael Walsh on The Chosen Reservoir and more straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to our fourth and final installment of this remarkable conversation with an extraordinary author and raconteur, and let me say, a great writer as well. The stories that we're touching on are very powerfully described, and the detail and the often gory truth of these last stands is something that Michael Walsh captures magnificently, and we're delighted to have a chance to visit with him a bit about it. You mentioned, Michael, at the outset that your own father served at one of these extraordinary last stands that are the focus of your newest book, Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. Tell us a little bit about his personal story, if you would, but also the bigger portrait that you paint of that battle.
Sure. Well, my family is from Ireland. In fact, I went back to Ireland in the early 1970s, reconnected the family. My great-grandmother, my Irish great-grandmother, came over in the late 19th century. And today I own that property and rebuilt her birthplace and in fact, built my studio within the ruins of the old stone house where she was born and where as a young girl she decided that she needed to get to the United States in order to survive. So we have the immigrant experience. As I also mentioned, he has an Indian grandmother who came down from Nova Scotia and settled in Wakefield, Massachusetts. So he comes from two, my point being, he comes from two fighting stocks. And the Marine Corps, those who don't know any Marines may be interested to learn, is heavily Irish-American, heavily. Seems like everybody, all the commandants are named O'Brien. And also a lot of Native Americans go into the Marines. They find that ethos compatible. And also Southwestern Hispanics. If you go to any rural church in New Mexico and Arizona, you will see shrines to these boys who were killed in our modern wars in the uniforms of Marine Corps enlisted men. So the Corps has this strong ethnic tradition, which I think sometimes goes unsung in our politically correct era. So he joined the Marines and married my mother. They had me, and then he was suddenly called to land at Pusan when the North Koreans attacked the South in 1950. He landed at Incheon with MacArthur during that famous landing, and then he fought his way up through Seoul and up to the very tippy top of what was then South Korea, the Chosin Reservoir. And at that point in November of 1950, the Chinese communists entered the war and they attacked the Marines in overwhelming numbers. And the battle is considered one of the greatest in Marine Corps history in that the Marines didn't break. They held their lines and they fell back. They marched all the way back to the sea, holding off the Chinese army as they went. And many of them were decorated. My father was awarded a Bronze Star for heroism in that battle. And they got back, quite a number of them got back. But I asked him at one point, were you afraid? And he said, he looked at me like I was crazy. And he's still alive. He's 90, he'll be 95 in June. He said, no, you don't have time to be afraid. This is something that women and I think some of the more, shall we say, masculinity charged men don't understand is you don't have time to be afraid. You don't worry. You're not, you know, talk about trauma, guys. Grow up. What you have is time to follow your training, as he said, and protect your fellow soldier and do your job. He said to me, I said, what'd you do when you got attacked? He said, we went to work. And that's how he looks at it. And I think any soldier will tell you that's how they looked at it too. If you follow your training and keep discipline and keep order, and this is true from the Greeks to now, you have a chance to live in one of these situations. If you panic, break your line and run, you will die. And that's your choice. You're done. So that's how they survived.
Speaking of being done, there are those who believe, Michael Walsh, that we may be, as a result of sort of the cumulative effects of, well, decades of relative peace. Of course, some number of Americans have volunteered to go off and fight various conflicts for the rest of us. But famously, you know, Karl Rove described the mission of America in the midst of one of those moments as to go shopping. And we've talked a little bit about the feminization and trying to detoxify masculinity and to promote the idea of women in combat. And we now have a new administration, the Biden team that has taken office under the leadership of a 4-star general, Lloyd Austin, who is now the new Secretary of Defense. And its immediate purpose seems to be purging the military of men, presumably, perhaps women too, but certainly men, who have in some way, shape, or form evinced a sympathy for America First, as Donald Trump has called it, or perhaps Donald Trump himself. Where are we in the struggle to assure that we have what it takes to defend this country in the future against enemies who seem to have learned rather better than we some of the lessons that you've described in this book, Last Stands?
Well, our current enemies don't subscribe to any of these modern notions about feminism, three cups of tea with your enemy. The Romans would have laughed at this, of course. They would have just crushed the city, killed everybody, burned it to the ground, and moved on. And yet, even back in those times, when you read Plutarch's account of Mark Antony's disastrous war against the Parthians, and having to fight his way back to his own lines, the Parthians would occasionally stop and say, "Hey, Romans, nice job there. You really got us, but we'll get you tomorrow." There was a kind of camaraderie, which we're losing. The question is, do we have the will to fight anymore? As someone pointed out, we haven't won a war since the War Department became the Defense Department. And my own personal feeling is that the war in Afghanistan is such a colossal disgrace and a stain on American honor that it could only have been intentional that first the wretched Bush administration and followed by a succession of wretched administrations, right up until the point where Trump tried to get our troops back from this. The fact that this has gone on for 20 years, it tells you they're not really serious. And if you are a young man or even a young woman now who wants to join the army and fight to win, you're joining the wrong army. Go join the Chinese army. They're not very good. And in an open battle, we would easily defeat the Chinese. The notion that the Chinese are 10 feet tall when in fact they're 5 feet tall is absolutely crazy. They have never won a war against an outside force ever. They get beat by every single person who fights them. They lose to the Tamerlane and to the Muslims and to the Mongols, and the Vietnamese beat them, and the Japanese beat them twice within 10 years with two platoons armed with steak knives. I mean, they are the most incompetent fighters in the world, yet they're devious and they play on our own weaknesses, and they use money in order to bribe us into the current weak position we are. So that's all I have to say about the 10-foot tall Chinese at the moment. But we cannot win if you don't want to win. There is such a thing as magnanimity, and Grant understood this, but Grant and Sherman also understood you first have to beat them down so bad they cannot get up again. Then you can afford to be magnanimous. You don't stop the fight in the middle of the fight. You fight to win. The Marine Corps ethos is put your man on the ground and make sure he does not get up to shoot you in the back. And we have fought a war in which literally we are getting shot in the back for 20 years in godforsaken parts of the world that had absolutely nothing to do with our security. It's been a national disgrace.
Just very quickly, and we've only got about a minute and a half left, Michael Walsh, endless wars is a term that's now being used, among others, to describe Afghanistan. It does seem as though we've lost the perspective that you just alluded to there, that you either win a war or you effectively surrender. You don't simply stop a war without one of those conditions applying. Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything. We have effectively surrendered. We should have won Afghanistan in 2 weeks and left, but we don't. It's rude now to defeat your enemy and destroy him. That somehow seems to be toxic. It seems to be hegemonistic, racist, whatever. The fact is, either you want to live or you want to die. So that's your choice. And now we've elected an administration that clearly does not want the U.S. as founded to live. And that's something we're going to have to deal with for the next 4 years, unfortunately.
A topic to which we will return with you, Michael Walsh, I hope in the very near future. In the meantime, thank you for spending this hour with us, and congratulations again on this excellent new book, Last Stands, Why Men Fight When All Is Lost. I hope you'll all check it out. Michael, we'll talk with you again soon. I hope we'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.